Chapter 10. I am glad that the Turkish part of Athens was extinct, so that I should not be balked of the pleasure of entering an eastern town by an introduction to any garbled or incomplete specimen of one. Smyrna seems to me the most eastern of all I have seen, as Calais will probably remain to the Englishman the most French town in the world. The jackboots of the postilions don't seem so huge elsewhere, or the tight stockings of the maidservants so Gallic. The churches and the ramparts, and the little soldiers on them, remain forever impressed upon your memory, from which larger temples and buildings, and whole armies have subsequently disappeared. And the first words of actual French heard spoken, and the first dinner at Ulick's, remain after 20 years as clear as on the first day. Dear Jones, can you remember the exact smack of the white hermitage, and the toothless old fellow singing Argo Olfactotum? The first day in the East is like that. After that there is nothing. The wonder is gone, and the thrill of that delightful shock, which so seldom touches the nerves of plain men of the world, though they seek for it everywhere. One such looked out at Smyrna from our steamer, and yawned without the least excitement, and did not betray the slightest emotion, as boats with real Turks on board came up to the ship. There lay the town with minarets and cypresses, domes and castles. Great guns were firing off, and the blood-red flag of the Sultan flaring over the fort ever since sunrise. Woods and mountains came down to the gulf's edge, and as you looked at them with the telescope, there peeped out of the general mass a score of pleasant episodes of Eastern life. There were cottages with quaint roofs, silent cool kiosks, where the chief of the eunuchs brings down the ladies of the harem. I saw Hassan, the fisherman, getting his nets, and Ali Baba going off with his donkey to the great forest for wood. Smith looked at these wonders quite unmoved, and I was surprised at his apathy, but he had been at Smyrna before. A man only sees the miracle once, though you yearn over it ever so, it won't come again. I saw nothing of Ali Baba and Hassan the next time we came to Smyrna, and had some doubts, recollecting the badness of the inn, about landing at all. A person who wishes to understand France or the East should come in a yacht to Calais or Smyrna, land for 2 hours, and never afterwards go back again. But those 2 hours are beyond measure delightful. Some of us were querulous up to that time, and doubted of the wisdom of making the voyage. Lisbon, we owned, was a failure, Athens a dead failure, Malta very well, but not worth the trouble and seasickness. In fact, Baden-Baden or Devonshire would be a better move than this. When Smyrna came, and rebuked all mutinous cockneys into silence. Some men may read this who are in want of a sensation. If they love the odd and picturesque, if they loved the Arabian Nights in their youth, let them book themselves on board one of the peninsular and oriental vessels, and try one dip into Constantinople or Smyrna. Walk into the bazaar, and the East is unveiled to you. How often and often have you tried to fancy this, lying out on a summer holiday at school? It is wonderful, too, how like it is. You may imagine that you have been in the place before, you seem to know it so well. The beauty of that poetry is, to me, that it was never too handsome. There is no fatigue of sublimity about it. Schacabac and the little barber play as great a part in it as the heroes. There are no uncomfortable sensations of terror. You may be familiar with the great Afrit, who was going to execute the travelers for killing his son with a date stone. Morgana, when she kills the 40 robbers with boiling oil, does not seem to hurt them in the least. And though King Shahriar makes a practice of cutting off his wives' heads, yet you fancy they have got them on again in some of the back rooms of the palace, where they are dancing and playing on dulcimers. How fresh, easy, good-natured, is all this. How delightful is that notion of the pleasant Eastern people about knowledge, where the height of science is made to consist in the answering of riddles. And all the mathematicians and magicians bring their great beards to bear on a conundrum. When I got into the bazaar among this race, somehow I felt as if they were all friends. There sat the merchants in their little shops, quiet and solemn, but with friendly looks. There was no smoking, it was the Ramadan. No eating, the fish and meat fizzing in the enormous pots of the cook shops are only for the Christians. The children abounded. The law is not so stringent upon them, and many wandering merchants were there selling figs in the name of the Prophet, doubtless, for their benefit, and elbowing onwards with baskets of grapes and cucumbers. Countrymen passed bristling over with arms, each with a huge bellyful of pistols and daggers in his girdle, fierce, but not the least dangerous. Wild swarthy Arabs, who had come in with the caravans, walked solemnly about, very different in look and demeanor from the sleek inhabitants of the town. Greeks and Jews squatted and smoked, their shops tended by sallow-faced boys, with large eyes, who smiled and welcomed you in. Negroes bustled about in gaudy colors, and women, with black nose bags and shuffling yellow slippers, chattered and bargained at the doors of the little shops. There was the rope quarter and the sweetmeat quarter, and the pipe bazaar and the arm bazaar, and the little turned-up shoe quarter, and the shops where ready-made jackets and pelisses were swinging, and the region where, under the ragged awning, regiments of tailors were at work. The sun peeps through these awnings of madder canvas, which are hung over the narrow lanes of the bazaar, and ornaments them with a thousand freaks of light and shadow. Khoja Hassan al-Habal's shop is in a blaze of light, while his neighbor, the barber and coffee house keeper, has his premises, his low seats and nargles, his queer pots and basins, in the shade. The cobblers are always good-natured. There was one who, I am sure, has been revealed to me in my dreams, in a dirty old green turban, with a pleasant wrinkled face like an apple, twinkling his little gray eyes as he held them up to talk to the gossips, and smiling under a delightful old gray beard, which did the heart good to see. You divine the conversation between him and the cucumber man, as the Sultan used to understand the language of birds. Are any of those cucumbers stuffed with pearls, and is that Armenian with the black square turban Harun al-Rashid in disguise, standing yonder by the fountain, where the children are drinking the gleaming marble fountain, checkered all over with light and shadow, and engraved with delicate arabesques and sentences from the Quran? But the greatest sensation of all is when the camels come. Whole strings of real camels, better even than in the procession of Bluebeard, with soft rolling eyes and bended necks, swaying from one side of the bazaar to the other to and fro, and treading gingerly with their great feet. O you fairy dreams of boyhood! O you sweet meditations of half-holidays, here you are realized for half an hour. The genius which presides over youth led us to do a good action that day. There was a man sitting in an open room, ornamented with fine long-tailed sentences of the Quran. Some in red, some in blue, some written diagonally over the paper, some so shaped as to represent ships, dragons, or mysterious animals. The man squatted on a carpet in the middle of this room, with folded arms, waggling his head to and fro, swaying about, and singing through his nose choice phrases from the sacred work. But from the room above came a clear noise of many little shouting voices, much more musical than that of Naso in the matted parlor, and the guide told us it was a school, so we went upstairs to look. I declare, on my conscience, the master was in the act of bastinadoing a little mulatto boy. His feet were in a bar, and the brute was laying on with a cane. So we witnessed the howling of the poor boy, and the confusion of the brute who was administering the correction. The other children were made to shout, I believe, to drown the noise of their little comrades howling, but the punishment was instantly discontinued as our hats came up over the stair trap, and the boy cast loose, and the bamboo huddled into a corner, and the schoolmaster stood before us abashed. All the small scholars in red caps, and the little girls in gaudy handkerchiefs, turned their big wondering dark eyes towards us, and the caning was over for that time, let us trust. I don't envy some schoolmasters in a future state. I pity that poor little blubbering Mohammedan. He will never be able to relish the Arabian Nights in the original, all his life long. from this scene we rushed off somewhat discomposed to make a breakfast off red mullets and grapes, melons, pomegranates, and Smyrna wine, at a dirty little comfortable inn, to which we were recommended. And from the windows of which we had a fine cheerful view of the gulf and its busy craft, and the loungers and merchants along the shore. There were camels unloading at one wharf, and piles of melons much bigger than the Gibraltar cannonballs at another. It was the fig season, and we passed through several alleys encumbered with long rows of fig dressers, children, and women for the most part, who were packing the fruit diligently in two drums, dipping them in salt water first, and spreading them neatly over with leaves. While the figs and leaves are drying, large white worms crawl out of them, and swarm over the decks of the ships which carry them to Europe and to England, where small children eat them with pleasure, I mean the figs, not the worms, and where they are still served at wine parties at the universities. When fresh they are not better than elsewhere, but the melons are of admirable flavor, and so large, that Cinderella might almost be accommodated with a coach made of a big one, without any very great distension of its original proportions. Our guide, an accomplished swindler, demanded $2 as the fee for entering the mosque, which others of our party subsequently saw for sixpence, so we did not care to examine that place of worship. But there were other cheaper sites, which were to the full as picturesque, for which there was no call to pay money, or, indeed, for a day, scarcely to move at all. I doubt whether a man who would smoke his pipe on a bazaar counter all day, and let the city flow by him, would not be almost as well employed as the most active curiosity hunter. To be sure, he would not see the women. Those in the bazaar were shabby people for the most part, whose black masks nobody would feel a curiosity to remove. You could see no more of their figures than if they had been stuffed in bolsters, and even their feet were brought to a general splay uniformity by the double yellow slippers which the wives of true believers wear. But it is in the Greek and Armenian quarters, and among those poor Christians who were pulling figs, that you see the beauties. And a man of a generous disposition may lose his heart half a dozen times a day in Smyrna. There was the pretty maid at work at a tambour frame in an open porch, with an old duenna spinning by her side, and a goat tied up to the railings of the little court garden. There was the nymph who came down the stair with the pitcher on her head, and gazed with great calm eyes, as large and stately as Juno's. There was the gentle mother, bending over a queer cradle, in which lay a small crying bundle of infancy. All these three charmers were seen in a single street in the Armenian quarter, where the house doors are all open, and the women of the families sit under the arches in the court. There was the fig girl, beautiful beyond all others, with an immense coil of deep black hair twisted round a head, of which Raffle was worthy to draw the outline, and Titian to paint the color. I wonder the Sultan has not swept her off, or that the Persian merchants, who come with silks and sweetmeats, have not kidnapped her for the Shah of Tehran. We went to see the Persian merchants at their Khan, and purchased some silks there from a swarthy black-bearded man, with a conical cap of lamb's wool. Is it not hard to think that silk spot of a man in a lamb's wool cap, in a caravanserai, brought hither on the backs of camels, should have been manufactured after all at Lyons? Others of our party bought carpets, for which the town is famous. And there was one who absolutely laid in a stock of real Smyrna figs, and purchased three or four real Smyrna sponges for his carriage. So strong was his passion for the genuine article. I wonder that no painter has given us familiar views of the East. Not processions, grand sultans, or magnificent landscapes, but faithful transcripts of everyday Oriental life, such as each street will supply to him. The camels afford endless motives, couched in the marketplaces, lying by thousands, in the camel square, snorting and bubbling after their manner, the sun blazing down on their backs, their slaves and keepers lying behind them in the shade. And the caravan bridge, above all, would afford a painter subjects for a dozen of pictures. Over this Roman arch, which crosses the Meuse River, all the caravans pass on their entrance to the town. On one side, as we sat and looked at it, was a great row of plane trees. On the opposite bank, a deep wood of tall cypresses, in the midst of which rose up innumerable gray tombs, surmounted with the turbans of the defunct believers. Beside the stream, the view was less gloomy. There was under the plane trees a little coffee house, shaded by a trellis work, covered over with a vine, and ornamented with many rows of shining pots and water pipes, for which there was no use at noonday now, in the time of Ramazan. Hard by the coffee house was a garden and a bubbling marble fountain, and over the stream was a broken summer house, to which amateurs may ascend for the purpose of examining the river, and all round the plane trees plenty of stools for those who were inclined to sit, and drink sweet thick coffee, or cool lemonade made of fresh green citrons. The master of the house, dressed in a white turban and light blue pelisse, lolled under the coffee house awning, the slave in white with a crimson striped jacket, his face as black as ebony, brought us pipes and lemonade again, and returned to his station at the coffee house, where he curled his black legs together, and began singing out of his flat nose to the thrumming of a long guitar with wire strings. The instrument was not bigger than a soup ladle, with a long straight handle, but its music pleased the performer, for his eyes rolled shining about, and his head wagged, and he grinned with an innocent intensity of enjoyment that did one good to look at. And there was a friend to share his pleasure. A Turk dressed in scarlet, and covered all over with daggers and pistols, sat leaning forward on his little stool, rocking about, and grinning quite as eagerly as the black minstrel. As he sang and we listened, figures of women bearing pitchers went passing over the Roman bridge, which we saw between the large trunks of the plains, or gray forms of camels were seen stalking across it, the string preceded by the little donkey, who is always here their long-eared conductor. These are very humble incidents of travel. Wherever the steamboat touches the shore, adventure retreats into the interior, and what is called romance vanishes. It won't bear the vulgar gaze, or rather the light of common day puts it out, and it is only in the dark that it shines at all. There is no cursing and insulting of gyres now. If a cockney looks, or behaves in a particularly ridiculous way, the little Turks come out and laugh at him. A Londoner is no longer a spittoon for true believers. And now that dark Hassan sits in his divan and drinks champagne, and Selim has a French watch, and Zuleika perhaps takes Morrison's pills, Byronism becomes absurd instead of sublime, and is only a foolish expression of Cockney wonder. They still occasionally beat a man for going into a mosque, but this is almost the only sign of ferocious vitality left in the Turk of the Mediterranean coast, and strangers may enter scores of mosques without molestation. The paddle wheel is the great conqueror. Wherever the captain cries, "Topper!" civilization stops, and lands in the ship's boat, and makes a permanent acquaintance with the savages on shore. Whole hosts of crusaders have passed and died, and butchered here in vain. But to manufacture European iron into pikes and helmets was a waste of metal. In the shape of piston rods and furnace pokers it is irresistible, and I think an allegory might be made showing how much stronger commerce is than chivalry, and finishing with a grand image of Mahomet's crescent being extinguished in Fulton's boiler. This, I thought, was the moral of the day's sights and adventures. We pulled off to the steamer in the afternoon, the inbet blowing fresh, and setting all the craft in the gulf dancing over its blue waters. We were presently underway again, the captain ordering his engines to work only at half power, so that a French steamer which was quitting Smyrna at the same time might come up with us, and fancy she could beat their irresistible Tagus. Vain hope! Just as the Frenchman neared us, the August shot out like an arrow, and the discomfited Frenchman went behind. Though we all relished the joke exceedingly, there was a French gentleman on board who did not seem to be by any means tickled with it, but he had received papers at Smyrna, containing news of Marshal Bugeaud's victory at Issylee, and at this land victory to set against our harmless little triumph at sea. That night we rounded the island of Midolin. And the next day the Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.